Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. The Story and the Song, two conversations this week on Soundings. First, a discussion featuring Eudora Welty, the author of many novels and stories. Following that, a discussion about poetry in America, featuring Helen Vendler, professor of English at Harvard University and poetry critic for The New Yorker. Eudora Welty recently participated in a conference on Southern literature sponsored by the Department of English at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Among her books is One Writer's Beginnings, published in paperback in 1985. Eudora Welty, welcome to the National Humanities Center and to Soundings. It's an honor to have you at our microphones. Let's talk about One Writer's Beginnings. I remember reading a line from a friend, I believe an editor, who said, "Be sure to get your moon in the right part of the sky." Do you still feel that way about yourself as a writer? What does that mean to you?
Well, it means to absolutely know your fundamentals and have your feet on solid ground when you venture anything. That was a marvelous piece of advice to give me, because I was prone to be rather free-handed with things, I would say. You know, if I wanted a sunset, I'd have it, even though it might be 2 o'clock in the afternoon in the wrong direction.
Did you ever get the moon out of the sky, and what happened when you did?
I did get it. Well, I don't know. I nearly always had moons in the thing. You know, a romantic turn of mind. Mm-hmm. This was Herschel Brickell, a good critic. That was sound advice. Mm-hmm. I would give it to anybody to get your facts right. I don't want to be confined when I write a story, because I want to get at the human truth and human relationships.
Well, you say that you always move from the particular to the general, that you never begin with generalities. What kinds of particularities are on your mind now?
Well, suppose I'm writing a story about some things now. I would take this location and who you were and why you were here and what kind of day this was and your gesture, like punching your cheek with your fountain pen and then whoever was sitting here the same way. And then what kind of relationship was struck up just by our conversation. I mean, I would start from scratch, you know.
You write, for instance, Eudora Welty, about seeing and acquiring a voice and listening. Do you hear what the critics have said about your work? Does that matter to you? Has it in any way shaped your expressive voice?
I'm not sure that I have kept up with a great percent of it. It just doesn't come my way. And it's not that I'm disparaging it, but I'm interested, of course. And as I say, for instance, Lewis Rubin, things he's written about my work, I find very valuable. I don't try to keep up with things in general that way. I mostly am a fiction reader, just as I'm a fiction writer. And the theory part has never been very conscious with me. I've tried to act conscientiously and consciously in the critical things, and I've done my share of essay writing and book reviewing. But while you're writing fiction, it's like being, I think of it as being downstream on a river, and writing criticism is upstream. Your mind is not working the same way, both ways.
Speaking of streams, again, in One Writer's Beginnings, you point out that the streams that feed your imagination have been both dark and bright. That instantly made me remember a line from a wonderful story by Nathaniel Hawthorne. "Blessed are all the emotions, be they dark or bright." It's the intermixture of the two that you have to look out for.
Of course it is.
Tell me about that in your writing.
I hadn't thought about looking out for it. I hadn't thought of any conclusion to draw from that. I just thought they both exist. Well, it's just because what you try to do, I think, in fiction is reflect life mm-hmm. the way it is.
Let's put a loaded word like guilt on the table. You've pointed out that is and yet oddly is not an element in your writing. Can you comment on that for me?
I don't know. Again, it's thinking of work in a way that a writer doesn't think of it. You know, if it comes into play in the course of a situation or a character you're using in fiction, mm-hmm. all right, but I don't look around and say, let's see, I better bring some guilt into this. I don't do that.
Two cupfuls.
Certainly it's part of our life. I mm-hmm. mean, and we all feel it from time to time, and it's very powerful and potent.
What did you mean, Eudora Welty, when you said that the emotions do not grow old? But they haven't stayed static, I take it.
No, they're alive. That's why they don't grow. I mean, I think they always stay susceptible and aware and analytical, perhaps. I mm-hmm. mean, whatever is your personal nature mm-hmm. to deal with your feelings, you keep on handling them that way.
I remember reading an essay about seeing and learning and acquiring a vocabulary as a writer, a line from the American biologist Louis Agassiz, who says to his students, look at your fish. Take a look at what is around you. Tell me, Eudora Welty, how did you acquire that ability, that talent for seeing? Is that again, something too mysterious to recall? Can you comment on that for me?
I don't know. I'm sure I was born. Most people are born looking around them, I mm-hmm. guess. And I have a visual mind, the most common form, I'm sure. I visualize everything, and I'm a pretty good observer. And I'm sure I've trained myself to be a better one in the course of my life. Mm-hmm. And I draw ideas and conclusions from what I see often, never by idea.
Who is it that you read today, Eudora Welty?
Everybody. I mean, I read for pleasure, whatever I... Mm-hmm. I can't think what I'm reading now. I'm reading the new editions of Chekhov that... Echo Press, it just brought out in 13 volumes, mm-hmm. and just reading them again. And B.S. Pritchett has just published his new biography of Chekhov, which I got the day I left home. Mm-hmm. I'm going to read that. Mm-hmm. And,
Eudora Welty, is there a young Eudora Welty on the literary scene today? Do you think of yourself as having some sort of a mantle that you want to pass on in literary terms?
No, I don't hand out or pass out any kind of advice. There are a lot of people writing now that I'm thrilled to read. Your writers here, mm-hmm. Ann Tyler, mm-hmm. Elizabeth Spencer, and Clyde Edgerton
mm-hmm. and writers in and around Chapel Hill.
Yeah, all these around Chapel Hill mm-hmm. are fascinating to me, and I have been reading them mm-hmm. along. I haven't just found them. Mm-hmm. Been reading them.
Eudora Welty, let's move toward a conclusion of our informal conversation. Let me look at you wide-eyed and ask you a question. What good is literature?
Heavens, that does leave me wide-eyed. It's all the good.
Isn't it? Let me be just a little impertinent. Isn't that a little old-fashioned and kind of stuffy to talk about literature in those terms?
I hope not. I don't think it matters whether it's old-fashioned or not. Huh. It's here to stay. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I can't imagine life without a recourse to a treasure like that. It'd be like saying, let's throw all the paintings in the Atlantic Ocean that have ever been painted, you know. Okay, bring on Michelangelo, Goya, mm-hmm. everybody. It would be the same way if we lost, or worse if we lost our literature.
Eudora Welty, a footnote to our conversation. As you look back on the fiction that you have written, do you have a favorite story yourself, a character that has stayed with you more so than others, a particular story?
I don't know. They've been favorites for different reasons when I've written them, and some of them that I really like, I think, wouldn't be remembered by other people, perhaps. And it's hard to think back. It's like saying, what member of your family do you think really stands out?
Well, let me give you an example. What about R.W. Bowman, character in the first story that you published? Is he still present in your mind? This is the death of a traveling salesman.
I guess so. Yeah, I respect him and so on. He's not a person that You know, I don't go back and think about my stories that way.
Do the characters still talk amongst themselves and talk to you?
I don't know. I guess they're too close to do that. They're too close to me. They're being invented by me. I don't have to call them up, you know. I like Edna Earle Ponder a good deal in Ponder Heart. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I like some of my more frivolous characters whose lines would come to me, like I'd hear somebody say something on a bus. It would bring up a character to me, had no relation to what I heard on the bus. I remember those people, and I can hear their lines. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know who said it. I forget who said it in my story, but I love it because she said, I mean, they said she can spend all day trying to figure out how the little tail of the sea gets through the L and the Coca-Cola sign. I just love her. Well, that's not a rational reason. Mm-hmm. I just love people for various little tags and
bits. But you're certainly entitled to it. Very quick footnote to our conversation. We have been talking about your fiction, Eudora Welty. Is the South, in your opinion, still as important in American literary culture as it was, oh, you name it, 10, 15, 20, 50 years ago? Still distinctive as a region and important to us?
I think we have just as many writers, if not more now. But I think perhaps they've all come to the same conclusion I have, that we don't want to be identified and based and limited by being called Southern. Well, you know, I think that's a great limitation to set yourself behind. I'm proud that I'm Southern, and it's taught me a lot. Mm-hmm. But to identify me by that one word is to subtract something of what I'm trying to do. And this goes for all of us, I'm sure. Somebody else that agrees with me, I think, I was talking to you lately, is Richard Ford, who's a very fine writer. He was born in Jackson. And he writes about the whole place. There was recently at Millsaps College a little bunch of Southern writers talking about Southern writing. And that can get to be pretty cozy, you know. I'm proud of it and like this. It's not to deny it. Mm-hmm. It's just to say, okay, that's where we stand. Now let's look around. And I think everybody feels that.
Eudora Welty is the author of many novels and short stories. She participated in a recent conference on Southern literature, sponsored by the Department of English at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Story and Song continues. My guest now is Helen Vendler of Harvard University. Helen Vendler is poetry critic for The New Yorker. Helen Vendler, welcome to the National Humanities Center. The state of poetry in America. Let's begin with some generalizations. Where is it?
Well, it's very large. We're a much bigger country than most countries that have had poems, and so we have more than other places. I think we publish a great deal of poetry in small journals, in small presses, in trade presses, in university presses. And there's a very active scene of poetry reading going on all over the country, both in city venues and also in university venues. So I would say we are doing very well.
How do you measure this? By the number of poets who are publishing? By the number of publications? Do we talk in terms of public response, critical response? Give me some signals there.
Well, most of the major newspapers and journals do take notice of poetry. That is to say, there are regular poetry reviews in the New York Review of Books, in the New York Times Book Review, in the Washington Post, in the Boston Globe, in the New Yorker, what have you. Then there are lots of specialized criticisms that go on in academic journals, poetry magazine reviews regularly, that kind of thing. Parnassus is a magazine only of reviews. So I would say there's not only an enormous amount of poetry being published, more than any single critic can keep up with, but also a lot of very good criticism, I think, of a high level being written.
What about the quality of the poetry that Americans are producing in the 1980s? How do you get a handle on that?
Well, of course, like the quality of everything else produced in America, it goes from abysmal to excellent. And I think that you get a handle on the quality of it the way you get a handle on the quality of anything else. You try to sample as much as you can. You stick with the things you like the best. You follow the careers of the people who appeal to you most and hope that somebody in some other region is following the careers of the people they like most. Mm-hmm. It can be a new form. We haven't had as much public poetry in America as I would like, and it really was so astonishing to me to pick up Howard Nemiroff's new book and see, very shortly after the fact, a poem on the Challenger explosion.
Goodness.
And I didn't know that anybody was in the mood to write such a thing these days, and yet Howard Nemiroff had done that. So you can't tell what will come up the page at you.
You use a wonderful word, a small word, but an important word, and that is public. How, Helen Vendler, would you characterize the public duty, responsibility, role of the poet? Should we look at them as off on their own island? Do we circulate them in the society at large? Tell me about that.
One thing that would help would be that if poems were read in the schools, especially poems that had some relevance perhaps to the lives of the students, they might think of it as a form of commentary on their lives. Mm-hmm. I think most people get through school without seeing much in the way of poetry that they could regard as commentary on their lives, and so it's no surprise that they don't think of it that way. But I think the poet has no responsibility except to the art itself. That is to say, it's no good for a poet to say, I must be a monitor of Congress. I mean, that won't produce anything. But to be interested in the public life might mean that when something happened, like the Challenger explosion, you might be moved to respond to it. Mm-hmm. That happened with Nemiroff.
What about the notion of a poet's fidelity to, for lack of a better term, the tradition? That is to say, some people will tell you that poets are inherently subversive. They do new things, they think new thoughts, they, as you say, create new vocabularies. Yet it's impossible for them to operate without some sense of their own personal as well as cultural histories. There's a wonderful interplay. Is that a contradiction, or is that really a harmonious thing that's going on?
Well, they can't write except in the language they were born to. Keats says something about anyone would be a poet if he had a story to tell and were well-nurtured in his mother tongue. Hmm. And all of these poets are well-nurtured in their mother tongue. What Hart Crane said that the poet wanted was new thresholds, new anatomies. And I think that within a tradition you can find new thresholds and new anatomies without forsaking those old ways of thinking or ways of writing or ways of positioning yourself vis-a-vis a material that are common to poets for a long time. I think of, say, Adrienne Rich, who, looking at the tradition of the love sonnet, decided to write lesbian love sonnets. Mm-hmm. And that was both a retention of tradition and a departure from the usual way of the phrasing of love sonnets. So I think the new thresholds and new anatomies might be said to keep the old and do something new, cross a new threshold with them. Poetry has had a lot of social functions, and some of the poetry, quote-unquote, that has had an important social function, like hymns, which had an important social function for Emily Dickinson, as we know, since she wrote in that form all the time, are poems that appeal to a wide mass of people the way hymns do. And they perhaps serve as the ground in society, the ones that have an appeal to a wide mass of people, for the next level, which perhaps appeal to a smaller mass, the way popular folk music serves as the basis, say, for a Mahler symphony. And that interconnection between the folk music turns up in Beethoven as well, all kinds of folk tunes and folk rhythms. You wouldn't want to be without it. On the other hand, you wouldn't want that to be the only kind you had.
So this distinction that that critics, for example, like to make between high and low art, in many ways can be deceiving. It can be misleading in our judgment of criteria for what is and what is not poetry.
If you forget the connection, almost all the writers in America today were brought up on cartoons when they were children. Uh-huh. And the very form of the cartoon is animating American fiction. It can't help, and film as well. So that I wouldn't want anyone to forget the continuity. And the relation of image and word is coming, of course, closer all the time in certain forms of performance art or video art, that kind of thing. And the conjunction of the image and the word in the beautiful books that painters made with poets, for instance, is an old one that we know well, and is bound to happen again with things like words and video. And I expect more art forms to evolve.
Fair enough. Helen Vendler, you, in addition to writing reviews about poetry for The New Yorker and other publications, you're a professor of English at Harvard University. Let's talk about this wonderful debate that occurs before us in American society now about the training of young and tender minds, the humanities, again, the tradition, whether we should stick to some sort of a Western inheritance. We have a lot of fighting going on in popular circles as well as academic ones, even the government, the National Endowment for the Humanities, makes statements and pronouncements. Give me a sense of that with respect to the teaching, the writing, the reading, the study of poetry.
Well, as I've often said to my students, one of the reasons we call these works that we're reading now canonical is because poets are still reading them. Writers, I think, make the canon, as Hugh Kenner said. It's not professors, it's not anthologies, finally. It's the writers that other writers admire that stick around. And I was quoting to them a poem, for instance, just written by Jory Graham, a young poet out at Iowa, called "A Forced Sighs and Trusty Fearfulness." It's a line taken from Sir Thomas Wyatt, and we were reading the Wyatt sonnet in my survey of British literature, and I said to them, the fact that it's being quoted out in Iowa this very minute means there's something about this poem that still appeals to a young poet.
Uh-huh. And we place Wyatt where, the 16th, the
7th? 16th century,
yes. Uh-huh.
So that's why we're reading Wyatt, is because Jory Graham is quoting him now more than because somebody made up the anthology of literature. They uh-huh. make it up perhaps for the same reason, but it's the reason that the writing is still strenuous and of forced sighs and trusty fearfulness is a remark about life, that you go through it with forced sighs and also with trusty fearfulness, and that's a lasting remark, and it appeals still.
What about the charge that poetry, the humanities themselves in general, have become overly politicized? I guess you could say that they were always political or ideological in a sense. What's your sense of that?
Well, I was trained myself in a Roman Catholic family, so that I know very well about ideological control over literature. It seems to me that that has always gone on. And an attempt to control literature means, on the part of governments by censorship or on the part of different scholarly parties to get control over texts, means that literature still is a powerful object in culture, and the fact that people want to possess it, appropriate it, describe it in their terms rather than in someone else's terms seems to me at least a sign that it's a live object.
Uh-huh. So this is a good thing. This is a continuing tension that we should be essentially happy to see.
It's a continuing struggle. Yes, I think from my own point of view, I prefer a non-ideological base for criticism, that is to say, appropriative criticism. Let us think about women in such and such, or the representation of women, or let us think about the representation of the oppressed, or mm-hmm. is an understandable criticism, but it's not the criticism I like the best because it tends to leave out the things it doesn't happen to be looking at the time.
Uh-huh. Well, again, to become personal, do you think of yourself as a powerful person because you write reviews about poetry in The New Yorker?
Well, I think that you can kill a play with a review, but thank heavens you can't kill a book. And books uh-huh. that have been badly reviewed, we think of the poems of Keats or whatever, stick around long after the bad review, so that uh-huh. I feel even if I am mistaken in a review, and I hope not to be, but I don't expect it to be infallible any more than anyone else, I think that the book is not killable in the same way that a first night is, and I'm glad I don't have that power.
Mm-hmm. A footnote to our conversation, Helen Vendler, we're talking about poetry and the state of poetry in America in the 1980s. What's on your reading table? Got any recommendations for us? Names, titles?
Well, we have a wonderful set of living poets in America, ranging from ones who are now in their 60s. I'm thinking of people like Adrienne Rich or Howard Nemiroff or Amy Clampett or whatever, all the way down, James Merrill, Allen Ginsberg, notable poets, all of them, down to people. The last one I just read is a couple of young people, a young man named David Dooley, who just won the Nicholas Roerich Prize, and a young woman named Alison Stone, who just appeared in Poetry. Alison Stone's first book isn't out yet. David Dooley just brought out his first book. So I would say the field is in good shape, mm-hmm. Along with ones I've mentioned earlier, and someone who's here at the National Humanities Center right now, Rita Dove, who won a Pulitzer Prize last year for Thomas and Beulah. Mm-hmm. Someone, great regional poets, too. I think of poets who are writing about, say, the South, like Dave Smith, who has written a really notable account of what it is to grow up here in the South. Mm-hmm. All of these poets I read and follow with real interest. Jory Graham, whose work I've mentioned, worked with Martin Scorsese in filmmaking at NYU, and you were mentioning the influence of various forms of of other arts on poetry. It seems to me her poetry does show the influence of filmmaking. Mm-hmm. It wants to be a kind of cinematic process poetry rather than a static object poetry.
And a very quick footnote to our footnote, Helen Vendler. Quote me a line, give me some words that resonate in your mind. We've been talking about poetry. Let's hear mm-hmm. some. Give me a line or two that you think wonderfully memorable.
Well, you know, I often find coming back into my mind the line from Adrienne Rich, to do something very common in my own way. And I think that's what the poets are trying to do, though our culture doesn't often recognize that as their aim. It is something very common to make art and to make verse in a culture. It's been going on since the earliest recorded society, to do both a verbal art and verbal art that has a chantable or singable or metrical or rhythmical element, and to do it in one's own way. That is, the achievement of individual style is a very high cultural achievement, so that we recognize a voice and say, that's Tennyson, that's Hopkins, that's Browning. And to do something very common in my own way, as Rich said, seems to me very much what all the poets are trying to do. And the notion that poetry is difficult comes in part from the wish that the poet has to do it in her own way, so it won't sound like the language everybody else speaks. You have to learn the idiom of a poet. But once you've learned it, the rewards are like those of learning a new foreign language. You have a whole new area open to you.
Helen Vendler is a professor of English at Harvard University and poetry critic for The New Yorker. Among her recent books are Voices and Visions, American Poets, published by Random House, and The Music of What Happens, Essays on Poetry and Criticism, published by Harvard University Press. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Story and Song is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 440. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, conversations about modern French history. My guests will be Patricia O'Brien of the University of California at Irvine and Donald Reed of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The first week in March marks an anniversary for the ratification in 1789 of the Articles of Confederation, which governed the newly formed United States. Glenn Miller, the American band leader and musical composer, was born during the first week in March 1904. And the Peace Corps celebrates a birthday during the first week in March. It was established by President John F. Kennedy in 1961. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
The Story and the Song, this week on Soundings. Listen for Eudora Welty and Helen Vendler. Eudora Welty is the author of many novels and stories. Her recent books include One Writer's Beginnings. Helen Vendler is a professor of English at Harvard University and poetry critic for The New Yorker. Among her recent books is Voices and Visions, American Poets. Eudora Welty and Helen Vendler on The Story and the Song, this week on Soundings.